today's speaker is Michael Wollenberg. He's a PhD student in medical microbiology and immunology in Ned Ruby's lab. And today he'll be speaking, he's got a long title, about, I'll summarize, intraspecific diversity in the bioluminescent marine bacteria, Vibrio fischeri.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for all coming out on such a rainy day. What I want to talk today about is dealing with population biology of a bioluminescent marine symbiont at two different scales, both the population scale of the host and also at the scale of the individual host, so within a host. And in structuring this talk, I figured that I should abandon my normal way of lecturing, which is to try to squeeze everything that I have into some sort of oblique conceptual framework, and then pose brilliant, important general scientific questions, create hypotheses addressing those questions, and then tell you about data that address both the hypotheses and questions, and then recapitulate things and draw conclusions. Instead, today, since I'm a graduate student, what I'll be doing is since I didn't start out with any huge conceptual framework in my graduate career, I'm instead going to try to fascinate you with microbiology as a way of introduction to the system and microbial population biology. And then I will talk about some basic, loosely articulated, specific, and elementary questions that I came up with in collaboration with my mentor. And then I'll show you some data that we collected from some empirical work that we've done over the last couple of years. Try to reconsider these questions and maybe approach more of a conceptual framework, and then conclude and hopefully get your input and your questions and feedback. Okay, so to paraphrase the muse, we are living in a bacterial world, and I am a bacterial girl. Bacteria are the oldest, the richest, and the most abundant biology on the planet. Get used to it. It's true. If you ever read Maynard Smith's The Major Transitions in Evolution, and I forget his co-author, his surname is translated to be St. Mary, I think. As I figure it, bacteria facilitated four of eight of the major evolutionary transitions that Maynard Smith talks about. They are the biogeochemical Morlocks of our planet. They do all the important processes when it comes to cycling nutrients. And they are more metazoan than we are metazoan. If we take 100 cells from our body, 90 of those will be bacteria, and 10 of them will be us. So what is us? And as far as I can figure, bacterial species seem invincible in that we try very, very hard to extinguish some of them as metazoans, but we can't quite do it. And even the one that we thought we'd beat, smallpox, is still hanging around after all this time. So these are reasons that I'm fascinated by the bacterial world. And it's not all bread and roses. It's also some challenges. Namely, we have real problems with trying to distinguish bacterial species. So if you're talking about bacterial populations, species might become an important concept. And philosophically, it's difficult to get some sort of ubiquitous definition of species for all bacteria. So species and species concepts and speciation remain a challenge. Scale, we are at a completely different scale than microbes, so this remains a challenge to microbiologists. Large population sizes and undefined population boundaries, you're going to see that this figures into an important part of my talk. Cryptic metrics. So if we're trying to measure diversity or richness of a given microbial community or population, we can't just go out to the African plain and look at the gazelles. I mean, we have to look under a microscope. We're limited by how we assess diversity within these populations. All bacteria pretty much under a microscope look the same. So how do we assess richness? How do we think about that? And then the problem that in a lot of populations of bacteria, some bacteria, even from the same species, are not culturable because they're in a different state, and some are. And then when we talk about communities, it's just a complete mess because some species are less or more culturable than other species. So when we take a sample of the given relative abundance of different species in a community or different strains in a population, we always have to keep in mind that what we see, what we get might not actually be what's there. Okay, this said, I still was fascinated at the beginning of my graduate career in trying to understand microbial populations. And as I was reading about it before I came to graduate school, it struck me that it seemed like there's this gradient of trying to understand microbial populations in either a very, very, very derived experimental context where you take a test tube and you test something like the intermediate disturbance hypothesis, and you say that this hypothesis holds true for your test tube, or you try to describe the natural ecology of a system where you have a completely open, unbounded community or population. You don't it's really hard to kind of define where things end and begin, especially in a hot spring, for example. Although this is probably one of the better examples of a boundary. In general, what you have is you have control, complete control, and experimental surety in a test tube, and then you have complete natural surety if you go to the environment and sample. So how do you try to straddle this gradient and do work that's scientifically relevant that can be examined experimentally, but also maintains its natural context? So in the context of our system, what I think about is we have this huge population of Vibrio fischeri. It's a bioluminescent marine bacteria. It's found all over the world. So how do I try to understand the natural population biology of the species? Well, I could go to every place on the Earth and sample bacteria from every place. That would be wonderful, but I don't have the time or money, or I'm allowed the money. So we have to focus on some sort of bounded system. And what happens to work really well for us is that metazoan symbioses are a natural boundary for bacterial populations. So in the case of the sepioled squid, they have bioluminescent symbionts that live inside of a light organ, and it's a monospecific association with a single species of bacteria with a single species of squid. So the advantages of using Euprima sculpies as an environment is that we have defined boundaries and environmental scales. This bilaterally symmetric light organ has two lobes, almost like your lungs, and there's about 100 million cells in these lobes. And we know that this bacterial species is also found in the sediment and the seawater habitats surrounding the squid environment as well. So we have some idea about the environmental scales and boundaries that this population may exist within. The bacterial population is easily sampled and it's experimentally tractable. So we can culture our bacteria very readily on marine agar plates. It doesn't seem like there's a large percentage of the population, the symbiotic population, that's viable and non-cultural, meaning that what we see is what we get when we culture our bacteria. And the symbionts are acquired horizontally, which means that when they hatch from their eggs as larvae, they do not have a symbiotic relationship with the bacteria. They have to acquire that from the environment. So they hatch into the marine environment, the symbionts are in the marine environment, and then they are acquired by the host. So this makes things experimentally tractable, because you can imagine that we can hatch juveniles into sterile seawater and then initiate a symbiosis with strains that we might want to look at the context of within this system. Okay, and bacterial genetics exists, so we can label and mark different strains using plasmids, etc., that have been worked out by former members of the lab. We have a lot of genomic knowledge in regards to two different Vibrio fischeri strains that have been completely sequenced, I think, at this point. If not, then they're very, very close. So we have this genomic beginnings that we don't have to pick our way through trying to figure out if we're going to do something like multi-locus sequence typing, which I'm going to tell you about later, using a bunch of different loci. Designing primers is very easy. Designing primers to repetitive sequences, which is a technique that we use for fingerprinting, is very easy because we have those genomic sequences. And then if I didn't say it explicitly, I think I did though, this is a monospecific association. So we're dealing with a single species of bacteria that lives in the light organ of Euprima sculpies. We don't have to deal with confounding effects of communities, which would make things more complicated, in my opinion. It also is a weakness as well. I'm not saying it's only good. Okay, so what is this light organ? Where is it? If we take Euprima sculpies and show you a dorsal view, flip it over eventually, this one's going to make the ultimate sacrifice. We cut it open, and you see that there's this light organ that's bilaterally symmetrical about in the middle of the squid. And this is actually open to the outside environment because the mantle water, which goes through past the gills, through the mantle, actually moves past this light organ. Thereby, the squid can have its symbionts inoculated into the light organ. And if I was to show you just the light organ morphology interior, what you'd see is that the light organ in the adult, which is what I just showed you, actually consists of a pore that opens up to the outside environment and then feeds ducts that go down into individual crypts, which are basically blind-ended epithelial-lined sacs, which hold the bacteria inside of the light organ. And these sacs obviously have a single pore and a single crypt here, but in the juvenile, there's actually three pores a single pore and three separate crypts here, but in the juvenile, these three crypts are derived from three crypts that have three separate pores. So initiation may be able to happen with distinct events in this, and I'll come back to that as well. And this is just to give you the relative sizes of the adult versus the juvenile. This is a half a millimeter. Okay, so kind of the beginning questions in the system are, do we find a diverse collection of bacteria, Vibrio fischeri, in each light organ lobe? So if we just take a single lobe, do we see that there's different strains or intraspecific diversity within that scale, within that host scale? And then if we look within the environmental scale of the single island of Oahu, we find different populations of Euprymnus sculpes in both of these bays. So do we find a diverse collection or interspecific differences between those two populations of Euprymnus sculpes that exist on Oahu? So we have several different scales that we can look at. And you may be wondering what the squid... So this is kind of the end of the first section, so I'll summarize, and then we can do a little demo, and I'll wake you up, and then we can go back to me talking again. But to summarize, bacteria are awesome, but they're enigmatic. Okay, there's a lot that we don't know, especially at the population level. Symbiosis, such as Vibrio squid, offer a good boundary and compromise between natural experimental extremes for the study of a bacterial population. So you may disagree with me there. We can have a beer after and talk about it. But I think that it's a good compromise between the natural and the experimental. Studies of natural populations in any system, and I haven't said this explicitly, they have to begin with an empirical analysis. So I may have been denigrating myself at the beginning, but I really do think empirical studies have a place and that they have to happen before you're going to look at a larger conceptual framework and test previous theories. So we need to know more about the intraspecific diversity in the light organ before we go and try to say something about, you know, intermediate disturbance hypotheses, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just using that as an example. Okay. So what do the squid use the bacteria for? This is not extremely pertinent, but I just like to do this because Ned and Margaret haven't seen it before, and I want them to come up here. So they're going to be two of the volunteers. And who else wants to volunteer and act out counter-illumination? All right.
You serious?
Yep. So Ned, you're going to be the lizard fish, so that means you have to lay down. No, you can leave the lights off. Yeah. So Ned is on the bottom of the ocean. He's the predator of the squid, the lizard fish. And Margaret, you can be the squid. So it's nighttime in Hawaii, and the squid is up in the water column, swimming around and feeding and mating and doing whatever squid do in the water column at night in Hawaii. Okay, now this particular squid, you'll be the moon. This particular squid, Eric, come up here. You have to be the bacteria. This particular squid has no bacterial symbiont. So the moon comes out, shines on top of the squid, and when, not in her eyes. Don't blind the squid. And what do we see? There's a shadow of a squid on the sand, and the squid swims over near the lizard fish, and triggers the lizard fish's eyes. The lizard fish sees the shadow and eats the squid. Grab it. Not a very fit lizard fish.
One out of two.
All right, Eric. So the next squid that comes swimming along has bioluminescent symbionts. You guys have to be in symbiosis here. As bioluminescent symbionts. So just imagine that these are glowing. Okay, these are actually dead, but imagine they're glowing. All right, now the moon comes out. The squid, instead of casting a shadow on the bottom, is going to manipulate the light that the bacteria are making to make itself invisible. So no shadow on the lizard fish. Now, where did the squid go? So this squid swims away to fight another day. And that's counter-illumination. That's what the bioluminescence is used for. Thank you.
Can I stay up here?
I would suggest the lizard fish not lose his day job.
Okay. The first question that we had was, what is the structure of the light organ population? So when we look inside a light organ, if we're looking at different individual bacterial colonies derived from a single bacterial cell, are all the bacterial cells the same, represented by the same color phenotypically and genetically, or are they all different, or somewhat different? So that was the first very basic question that we tried to ask in this system. And what we did is we went to Hawaii and collected adults straight from Hawaii, dissected them there, tried to get as close to what was natural as possible, so we didn't bring them into the lab, didn't raise them in the lab at all. These were all fresh caught from Hawaii. And we took 5 from Mauna Loa, or Kaneohe Bay, and 10 from Mauna Loa Bay. It's just important that you know they're from two different sources. It's not really important what the mantle length is or anything else. And we sampled them within 4 days in 2005. What we wanted is some sort of phenotypic or genetic way to look at intraspecific diversity among these different strains. So what we thought would work well is some sort of rapid fingerprinting technique to look at very highly resolved differences among genetic components within a chromosome of a bacteria. So what we came up with was a technique that's been done before. We just call it VF because the repetitive sequence that we designed a primer to is in Vibrio fischeri. Basically, bacterial chromosomes have these tandemly repeated sequences that are all around their chromosome. And what you can do is design a primer to them, like I said before, run a PCR reaction, and you actually PCR out the product between the two repetitive sequences. So that's chromosomal DNA. It's not the repetitive sequences themselves that you're PCRing. But between the repetitive sequences, you're getting a PCR product. You run that on a gel. I know these shouldn't be the same size, but to show you that some are bigger than other products. You run them on a gel, and you get a fingerprint for a given strain. Now, strain 2B has some sort of insertion deletion here. Maybe it has a single nucleotide polymorphism. Something screws up the primer annealing to that position because there's genomic heterogeneity or genetic heterogeneity between these different strains, and it's lost. Then we run our PCR reaction with the same primers, and we get a different fingerprint that's missing these two bands. Okay, so this is the way that we just were able to take DNA from a lot of different strains and analyze it very rapidly because this is one PCR reaction, and it gives us some sort of, it doesn't give us particular nucleotide sequences or anything, but it just gives us a whole scale analysis of genetic heterogeneity within a bacterial strain. So what we found is that when we took strains from a single light organ lobe, we saw that there were several patterns within that population in that lobe. And I've highlighted them by these three red boxes. It might be a little hard to see back there. I apologize. And what you see is that some are more abundant than others, et cetera, et cetera. But it wasn't like every single strain we analyzed by PCR was giving us a different fingerprint. In fact, it was mostly like there were 2 to 3 in every lobe that we analyzed, or 1 to 3 in every lobe that we analyzed. And of course, you're thinking what I'm thinking, which is resolution is all kind of in the eye of the beholder. So we designed this primer because it gave us resolution that was manageable. We had other primers that gave us a lot higher resolution and a lot lower resolution, but of course if we see no differences, that doesn't help us, and if we see too many, then it's impossible to make heads or tails of things. But I think that this is a good technique in that I'll present some more phenotypic data to back up that it's actually showing us differences among strains. Okay, so Eric, after hearing my last seminar, suggested that what I do is I take these fingerprints and I code them binary. So if a strain has a given band, it gets a 1. If it doesn't, it gets a 0. And I identify all the major bands for all the different strains, and there's about 18. I code them 1 or 0, and then I just analyze them by distance matrix. So I make I just simply transform them into a difference in distance between a given pattern versus another pattern. And then I put them onto a cladogram. So what I get is I get about 3 major groups that correspond to 3 major patterns that I see among all of my different strains from all of my different lobes of squid. So now I've moved from just a single lobe to looking at lobes within all of the samples that I collected. So I took all the major patterns from these lobes and used them as type fingerprints. And then I analyzed them using this agglomerative hierarchical clustering method, if that matters to anyone. And I did this several different ways, and I got always the same thing, which was I saw 2 major groupings in all of them, and in most of them, I saw this 3rd major cluster as well. And if you look at the patterns, yeah, these 2 share the same band, so maybe they're closer than the others. This isn't trying to say that things are more evolutionary related or anything. It's just simple distance by pattern similarity or pattern difference. Okay. We then went and analyzed phenotypic diversity of these same strains from these same lobes. And what we found is that bioluminescence intensity of colonies, motility of individual strains, colony color, siderophore production, siderophores are iron chelators that the bacteria excrete, and growth rate were all different among the different strains that we analyzed. But there were similar patterns in that it seemed like, but statistically when we analyzed it, there was a significant association between these given patterns and being, for example, bright, fast, and yellow for these 2. And if you remember, these are the 2 that are closer together on the fingerprint pattern analysis. So it makes sense maybe that they would have the same phenotypes as well, if you believe that this resolution level is correct to predict phenotypes. And then when we look at our 3rd group, the kind of outlier group, or the group that wasn't together with these, we see that the cells are generally more dim, more slow, and the colony color is more white. So it seems like we have phenotypic assays that recapitulate what we were seeing with our fingerprinting assays, and that's supported by statistical tests. To kind of summarize everything really quickly, what I've already told you is that we saw a minimum number of one to three rep, or a minimum to maximum number of one to three rep types per lobe, if we're looking at different strains. Minimum to maximum, two to three per squid. Total number in all samples, of course, was three. And then, interestingly, in 53% of the lobes, so a little more than half, we saw the most frequent rep type. And in about 75% of the squid, we saw this most frequent rep type. So this means that there's one pattern that was showing up a lot more than some of the other patterns that were there. And it didn't seem like the identity of the pattern really predicted if it was the most abundant or least abundant strain that was coming out of each of these lobes. So you might think that, you know, maybe pattern A or the brightest strains were always the most abundant in a given lobe, and that was not the case. There was no statistical association between phenotype and genotype and abundance. So it wasn't like the brightest ones were always, you know, the most abundant in a squid, which you might think if you think the squid's selecting for bioluminescent bacteria. Of course, these are all assays that are in vitro, kind of, so the bioluminescence on a plate doesn't necessarily recapitulate the bioluminescence in the light organ. All right, so if you're visual, this is what we found in a nutshell. You look at a single squid, you look at two lobes in that squid, and you see that there's some strains that are similar among the two lobes and some strains that are different, and each lobe generally has more than one strain, if you're going to allow me to call a strain something that was distinguishable genetically and phenotypically by our assays. Okay? What is the structure of the light organ population? What we can call this is polyclonal, so one to three rep types per lobe, one to three different types of bioluminescence, motility, et cetera, per lobe. And those were associated with each other, of course. And then two to three types per squid. And as I said, phenotype was associated with genotype, or fingerprint. All right, so our second question. When we look below the level of the lobe itself, when we look at the intrinsic morphology of a light organ, do we see that there's something within that, something about that morphology that's structuring this population? So we might guess that maybe the crypts have something to do with structuring this population in the light organ lobe. If they do, then we might expect that all of our similar strain might be found in a similar crypt, represented by a really crude white line here. But if crypts have nothing to do with structuring the population in the light organ lobe, then we're going to see that each crypt might be filled with all different types of strains. This is an experiment that I haven't done yet, to do in situ work trying to distinguish if in an adult animal there are different strains within a crypt. And if you think about it, it's a difficult experiment because we can't do tricks that community people do, like using fluorescent in situ hybridization of 16S sequences, for example, which is popular in bacteria. Because the 16S sequences for this species are so similar that there's not going to be different primers that we can design. So we have to get a little tricky with this, and this is in progress. But what I wanted to show you is we kind of went about it indirectly to test whether it seemed like in juveniles there was many cells that were initiating symbiosis, or if it seemed like there were very, very few cells that were starting the symbiosis in the juvenile, and therefore we might be able to assume or hypothesize later that that might be recapitulated in adults as a single clonal population in each crypt. Okay, that was a little complicated, but I wanted to make the point that juveniles, again, have three pores through which the bacteria can enter from the environment after the juvenile is hatched, and this may give it three different populations in each different crypt here. So that could lead to the patterns that we see if each initiation event is started by very, very few cells and does not get invaded by other cells from the environment as the juvenile is developing. Those are two big assumptions. But what we did is we started with a really, really simple hypothesis. And the hypothesis was, if we looked inside light organ lobes of juveniles via confocal microscopy, and we had added red and green fluorescent protein-expressing bacteria to these juveniles, if only one individual cell was getting into each crypt, we would only see crypts that either had all red bacterial populations or all green bacterial populations. Okay? If more than one are getting in, then we're going to see mixed populations. So we set up a straw man hypothesis. And what we found is that we did see crypts that had mixed populations of bacteria. So this convinced us that it probably wasn't that, since a certain proportion of all juveniles have these mixed crypts, it wasn't that all crypts are getting inoculated by a single cell. It's got to be more than one cell. Well, how many cells? So we tried to think about this in a modeling sort of sense to test another hypothesis that less than 5 cells of fishery per crypt initiate the symbiosis. And it's maybe easier if you look at the model that we came up with, which is if you have an isogenic strain that either is labeled with red or green, so this is the exact same genetic background, the only difference is that it has the exact same plasmid that either has red fluorescent protein or green fluorescent protein, and you mix that at a 50-50 ratio, and then you add it to a cohort of juveniles, what you're able to do is you're able to predict the number of crypts that will be one color versus the number of crypts that will be mixed based on the number of cells that are getting into each crypt. Okay, so if you follow with me, if one cell is getting into each crypt, 100% will be one color, 0% will be mixed. That makes complete sense, I hope. If two cells are initiating, then we have to take the probability of drawing a green cell from the environment into the crypt and drawing another green cell into the environment into the crypt, multiply those probabilities together, do it again for reds, and add them together, and that's our probability for getting a single color crypt when two cells are initiating. Does that make sense to everyone? Just kind of nod or nod. I see some of these. Okay. If we're going to talk about the probability of finding mixed crypts, then it's the probability of drawing one cell with two cells initiating. It's the probability of drawing one red cell and one green cell, or alternately drawing one green cell and one red cell. So that would be 0.5 times 0.5 times 2, which would be 0.5. Okay, and it's the same with one color. And then you can figure that the more that we are trying to draw the same color over and over again, the less the probability is that we're going to find a crypt with a single color in it. So the more cells that start, and that's shown by this graph, so the more cells that are initiating, the less probability that we're ever going to see a crypt that's going to have a single color in it, in a juvenile. Okay, so these are what experimental data look like, in that we had started out with things that were trying to be close to 50-50, but we don't ever hit that on the nose. So maybe we had 77-23. And what we would do is we would, because we had these values, and we could plug in the number of cells and determine the relationship between the number of cells and the probability of observing crypts with one color, we put that into this equation for cells from 1 to 10 and then fit this curve. And then we can go back and empirically determine how many cells we had based on the number of crypts of one color that we observed in a juvenile cohort. So we did this all empirically. It wasn't like we just observed the number of mixed crypts and said, well, there's 50% mixed. I don't know what that means. But we went back and we actually back calculated to if we saw, you know, 50% of the crypts were mixed, or one color in this case, 50% would have to be mixed. We would know that there's between 2 and 3 cells, and we could calculate that approximately. So we did that for a lot of different initial inoculations of bacteria, so I'll show you what the data actually look like. If we look at a confocal micrograph of these crypts, what you can see here is that, I didn't actually circle them. What you can see is on each side of this, I know it's tough to see, on each side of this there's actually 3 crypts here. There's a large first crypt, a smaller second crypt, and a tiny third crypt. And on the other side, it's a large green only first crypt, a smaller second crypt, and a tiny third crypt. Okay, so in this one, the first crypt number 1, or the large crypt, is mixed. The second crypt is all red. The third crypt is all green. In this one, the first crypt is all mixed. The large crypt is only green. The second crypt is red. The third one is mixed. So this is what the data would look like. And that was how I calculated mixed versus not mixed. And there's ways of getting around the fact that these emit at the same wavelength, or the overlap of the emission is close in some respects. But we generally didn't have problems distinguishing crypts from other crypts. And when we did, we were really conservative, and we still came up with the numbers that we came up with. So, and this is what we found, in that if we looked at adding different amounts of total cells of bacteria, per a given, so just putting them into the bowl with a cohort of juveniles, it didn't matter how many we added, to a certain extent. We always found that between one and three cells seemed to be initiating based on our model. Similarly, if we looked at inoculating the squid for 3 hours, so putting them in a bowl with bacteria for 3 hours versus doing it for 12 hours, there really didn't seem to be a there is no statistical difference between this normal distribution and this normal distribution. So it's again between one and three here as well. So very, very few cells seem to be initiating. And remember, because of the way that we set this up, we actually wouldn't know if there were 10 or more cells initiating because everything would be mixed. So we would never see one color crypts. So this is kind of the best case scenario that we saw a lot of crypts with one color, because otherwise we wouldn't have known how many cells were initiating. Okay, to recap, is there evidence for a population structure at the cell globe scale, so at the crypt scale? Not directly. I have not done anything in situ to show that there's these different strains and they're only in one crypt versus another. But indirectly, we've created this model, and this model argues that one to three cells colonize each crypt. And this may lead to clonal populations being observed in adults. I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying I should put may lead to clonal populations being in many crypts. It's a start. Okay, so our view of it is that... Oh.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead, Margaret.
In your mixed population, mm-hmm. were you able to take it out just a little longer and see if you know... So what time point were...
48 hours.
So have you taken any out to 96?
I have not, no. Those are experiments I'll do in the future, because I am interested in that. So Margaret's asking a question about, we can inoculate the juveniles for 3 or 12 hours, and then we can leave the bacterial population in their light organ, leave them alive for 2 days. And that's when I sacrifice them and then examine them by confocal microscopy. So 2 days is after the symbiosis has already been initiated. It seems like the population grows up and is grown up to where it would be normally. But if you bring them to 96 hours, it may be that things change, or it may be that we find that there's more coming in from the environment.
Or maybe the ones that are mixed now become monocysts.
That's true. We could also see it the other way. So, go ahead. I don't know your name. I'm sorry.
I'm Carl.
Carl.
Do you see any differences in the three crypts in how often they're mixed color versus not? Maybe the larger crypt gets more cells?
Right. Qualitatively, I haven't, but quantitatively, I haven't gone back and done the statistics to analyze that. Actually, Mark in our lab brought that up to me a while ago, so I should have done that by now, but I haven't. But I mean, qualitatively, I don't think that there's a difference, but of course, that's not very scientific. So. All right. Now we'll get into, maybe I can call this ecology and evolution. I wanted to know if there was evidence for population structure at the host population scale, and is there any evidence that Vibrio fischeri might be locally adapted to different host populations? So more of an ecological sort of question. And to get at this, I wanted to look at differences in the populations between Kaneohe Bay and Mauna Loa Bay, so populations of symbionts that we took from squid that were from either of these places. And we know that, so the bias kind of is that we know the squid populations are statistically different. If we look at female size, juvenile size from these females and female egg, the eggs that are laid by the female, we know that Kaneohe Bay in general is smaller than Mauna Loa Bay, and that's supported by statistics. It was done by Jen Kimball in 2002. We also know that there's some evidence that the haplotypes of cytochrome oxidase 1 between these two populations show that there's population structure there as well, but just because it was another slide, I didn't put it up there. So we have a couple ideas that the host populations might be different, and when we look at the symbiont populations, are they also different? So what we did is we found that there is a significant difference between proportions of genetic and phenotypic, basically characteristics from strains isolated from each location. So in general, Kaneohe Bay strains, and this is statistically significant, are brighter, faster, their colonies are yellow, and they have faster growth, and they're predominated by these two rep types, which were on the same branch of that that distance matrix that was created earlier for the fingerprints. And contrary to that, Mauna Loa Bay tend to be dimmer, they move slower, their white colonies, they have slower growth, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you have an explanation for that? I would think that the dimmer, slower, whiter group would be selected against if there's, unless there's some sort of...
My explanation is that these are all in vitro assays.
I'm sorry?
These are all in vitro assays.
Okay.
So if it's dimmer or slower on a plate, I don't think that speaks to how well it does in the light organ. We know that the bioluminescence, for example, is much brighter in the light organ when we look at the strain of Vibrio fischeri that we use most often in the lab. And when we plate it out on media in the lab, you can't see it at all.
Okay.
So yes. Yes, Scott.
Does the distribution of the VF reps in free-living bacteria accord at all to the distribution?
We'll talk about free-living at the end if you just wait some slides, because that's kind of a future goal. So Scott's asking a really great question about free-living versus symbiotic populations. For now, we're just focusing on the symbionts. Okay. Is there evidence that things are locally adapted? Well, no, not directly. We haven't done competition experiments between different strains. We haven't shown that things grow better or worse in seawater. We haven't done what Mara might be asking, where if we grow Kaneohe Bay strains versus Mauna Loa Bay strains in Mauna Loa Bay juveniles, do they persist? Do they initiate better, et cetera, et cetera? We haven't done those. But indirectly, it seems like different phenotypes and fingerprints are more prevalent in these different locations. So this may imply, or we may be able to then hypothesize, that there is local adaptation and test that hypothesis. Okay, and then there may be this ecological difference between these strains. So it may be that Mauna Loa Bay is the strains are different than Kaneohe Bay strains. But is there any evidence that this is an evolutionary difference? So if we look at hypotheses of phylogeny, does it seem like there's speciation happening? Does it seem like everything's a mess? What's the deal? So this is just a slide to show that when I'm thinking about evolutionary processes, and you folks can probably correct me on this, I think about doing things experimentally, which is possible in bacteria, in that you can do things like local adaptation. You can look at evolution, not necessarily in squid, but you can try to approach it naturally, or you can look in silico by trying to figure out, we don't have a fossil record for bacteria, so what we do instead is we look at genetic signatures as a recapitulated kind of fossil record of the genome, and look at nucleotide changes as being signals of evolutionary change. Okay. So what we did is we took our two chromosomes that we have in Vibrio fischeri, the large and the small. We designated different genes that we thought would be far enough apart on the chromosome that they wouldn't be under the same recombination event or the same insertion deletion. We also picked genes that are fairly non-selected for, in that they're housekeeping genes. So recombinase A is something that has to do with very basic DNA repair. So we didn't think it would be under high selection, for example. MALE dehydrogenase, central biosynthetic gene. We didn't think that this would be, responding differently to whatever squid it was in, although arguably we don't know. We took these seven loci, we took the sequences from each, and we looked at the most divergent strains from our Oahu population. And we created phylogenetic hypotheses for these strains for each of these loci individually. And we used maximum likelihood, we used maximum parsimony distance, and pretty much it gave us the same groupings for all of those three techniques. And what we found is that, you're not supposed to read these at all, just notice that the topology of the graphs are completely different. And to give you another kind of visual way of looking at this, if I take this group and say that this clade is the closest to this clade, then I'll color this clade red. So the closest to the ES213 group is always red. The furthest away clade is always purple. I was just trying to figure out a way to show these phylogenetic differences without showing you locus after locus tree after locus tree, because I think that would get pretty boring. And what you notice is that there's no rhyme or reason to any of this. So every locus we look at, it seems like there's different clades that are formed and there's different relationships among these clades. How do we visualize this? How do we think about this? Normally with phylogenetic trees, we have two taxa that are evolutionarily related to a common ancestor, and that they're separated from another common ancestor of two other taxa. That's how I think about phylogenetic trees. But what if in bacteria we have some sort of recombination event where this locus maybe has this sort of relationship among the taxa, but if we have another locus, it may be that this ancestral taxa has donated that locus or has given that locus to taxa B. And so what we have is something that may look like this sort of phylogenetic tree where B and C are actually closer together, and of course the common ancestor of A would have to give it to D as well. So recombination can change the relationships among different taxa for a given phylogenetic tree. Sorry, go ahead.
How many variable sites do you have in a given gene within this group?
The most and the least?
Adding like three or four informative characters?
Rec is the least. Do you want parsimony informative sites or?
Either.
So rec is the least, and I think it has less than 10 parsimony informative sites. And lux is the most, and I think it has 60 or so. But I would have to, I didn't include that in this talk. I thought it was too
detailed.
I guess
what I'm wondering is your incongruence really significant? I mean, are the branches that conflict actually well supported, or are they just unresolved in some of the genes?
Right, so when I bootstrap the relationships, yeah. Well, I can't give you a sense of that because I didn't include the bootstraps up there. But I think that my approach was to then concatenate all the loci together so that it would give me more information. And then,
if they agree.
What?
If the information agrees across the genes, it should give you.
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about here, is that I think a way to approach phylogeny that doesn't agree is to actually create a network instead of a tree. So if we have A and C, and for one locus it's the relationships are like this, and for the other it's like this, what statisticians have done is created something that's called a split network, where you can decompose this relationship into basically a parallelogram of uncertainty. So the common ancestor between all these strains cannot be determined basically from the phylogenetic information you have. And that's basically, like I said, that's represented by this fact that things are equidistant from each other here. There's no, A and C are not closer, or C and D are not closer than A and D because of this incongruence in the phylogeny. What I did is I concatenated all the loci that I had and then applied this method to them to see what sort of network topology I got for all the different strains. And I used an outgroup that was from a symbiont of Euprymna morsii, which is from Japan, so this was way out, not near anything else. And then, Scott, this is your, maybe it's informing something that you had asked about, but H905 is a free-living strain that we had from Hawaii back in a long time ago. And that was way out as well. But when we look at all the groups that we took from Oahu, and actually groups that were 20 years old as well, they all are in this major mess that's at the, on this slide. And it doesn't seem like they group by sampling location or anything else. There's a lot of network action happening here. So my conclusion from this is that there's a heck of a lot of recombination going on among the strains that are in these Oahu squid. It doesn't seem like there's a branch that's Kaneohe Bay, there's a branch that's Mauna Loa Bay, and we're seeing speciation. It seems like everything's mixing together. We wanted to take one step further, so away from the island scale, what if we look at Vibrio fischeri across the world. We have several strains that are fish symbionts. We have some strains that are free living. We have strains from North America, from the Pacific Rim, from the Mediterranean. Does it seem like there's anything within these strains that might differentiate them from other strains, or is it that evolutionarily they're all recombining as well and just a big mess? So we did the same sort of thing here where I'm showing you colors, etc. And it seems like there are some more general patterns, but everything is still sort of confused. When I show you the splits graph, or the splits tree method, what you see is that all of our Euprymna symbionts are down here from Oahu. We have H905, which is the environmental strain, EM17, which was that outgroup for the other phylogenetic hypothesis, and then ATCC, WH1, these are free-living strains, MJ1 and CG101 are fish symbionts, and SR5 and SA1 are Mediterranean symbionts of squid found in the Mediterranean. So it doesn't group like squid and fish. Instead, it seems to be Hawaii, and this is a strain from an Australian Euprymna species, Euprymna tasmanica. So Hawaii and Euprymna tasmanica have this fairly well-defined clade. We have a mess here because these are one strain each. These are a lot of strains from Oahu, whereas this is the only environmental strain we've ever found. And EM17 is one strain from Euprymna morsii. And then all of our other strains that are from different fish and squid are all at a different clade. So with this, I kind of take home that there's still recombination happening, but it seems like there's more of a distinction between these two clades. Of course, if we threw more EM17 type strains in H905 on here, then it would look just like the mess that I showed you before. So maybe it's a sampling thing as well. To show you that everything might not just be sampling, when I concatenate two loci that are housekeeping and take 200 Vibrionaceae, which is the group that's higher than the genus for these particular bacteria, I find that there's a really well-supported and distinct branch from the splits graph of all of these strains combined, and that branch is Vibrio fischeri. So the other Vibrio fischeri are here, whereas the Euprymna symbionts and the free-living Hawaiian strain are there. And this kind of allows me to think that there is recombination among the strains that are in the squid in the same area. There might be recombination globally among Vibrio fischeri, but when it comes to recombining with different species and swapping genes frequently, it doesn't seem like that's happening as much. Okay? All right, so to kind of summarize, because we got about 10 minutes left, how I'm interpreting these data is that there's these opposing forces of recombination and selection, right? So on an ecological timescale, we may have local adaptation to the different squid populations that are on Oahu, but there may be enough gene flow to get rid of that signal on an evolutionary timescale. So we don't see any sort of evolutionary differences among the Oahu strains or even among the strains that are global because they're exchanging genes frequently enough that there's no coherent evolutionary signal. So it seems like recombination abrogates any type of selection. That said, there does seem to be phenotypic and genetic differences among all these strains, and those are statistically different between the different populations of symbiont that we look at. So this may be the beginning of some sort of local adaptation, which would eventually lead to speciation if recombination wasn't in the way. This is just my opinion. And this, when I'm thinking about recombination in the system, I was reminded of something that Nicole brought up at a committee meeting, which is that Dyckhausen and Green proposed a bacterial species concept that had a lot to do with the biological species concept. If you know what the biological species concept is, it's that interbreeding groups form species. You can't breed with something that's not your same species. Maybe I'm paraphrasing too much. But they said that intraspecific recombination would be really frequent between strains within a species of bacteria. And interspecific recombination would be infrequent. So how I interpret that is that our data, I think, support this in that we have this intraspecific recombination happening like crazy among Vibrio fischeri, but when we look at that larger splits graph of Vibrio fischeri and other Vibrionaceae, we don't see support for a lot of recombination. And of course, we don't have as many loci, so maybe that's biasing it, but it's hard to get 200 strains worth of locus information from GenBank right now. All right, and then Roberts and Cohen actually did some experimental evidence for the Dyckhausen and Green theory, which was they looked at the interspecific recombination barrier in Bacillus right after this was proposed, and they found that there was a barrier the further away you got from the Bacillus species that they looked at. A pictorial summary of what I've showed you today, since we're down in 10 minutes. If you look in a given light organ for a given squid, you see that there's multiple genetic and phenotypic differences among the bacteria that you are able, the Vibrio fischeri that you're able to pick out from there. I interpret that as interspecific differences, different strains. One hypothesis for why this may be happening is that there's very, very, very few cells that inoculate each crypt of a juvenile, and these populations can grow up clonally in these crypts and become their own distinct populations, so no interspecific competition, and persist in the squid for the duration of the symbiosis. And this would give rise to several different phenotypic and genetic types being found in each adult light organ lobe. When we look at interspecific differences between Kaneohe Bay symbionts and Mauna Loa Bay symbionts, we find that there's statistically supported differences in frequencies of these characteristics. So it seems like strains from one side of the island or from one population of squid are different from the other. And I didn't say this, but the control was that we took 10 squid from Mauna Loa Bay. Do you remember that? And 5 from Kaneohe Bay. So we looked at random 5 from Mauna Loa Bay versus another random 5, and there was no statistical difference in this comparison. So it wasn't just the night we sampled on or the way that we split the data, at least for those 10 squid. All right, and looking at recombination, it seems like there's these diverse interspecific differences that are happening within a given lobe, but recombination is frequent. If we look at the island scale, recombination is also frequent. Okay, so no evidence of evolutionary differences that I can see or that I interpret. And then if we look at the global scale, well, it's less frequent, but how do you really, and this is something that I need to get some help with, is how do you really say that something is, you know, more or less structured when you're looking at phylogeny? It may just be, I guess, bootstrapping, but it's not my area of expertise right now. I'm learning more about it. All right, future directions for this system. I'd like to test these hypotheses for local adaptation and population structuring using more direct methods. So in situ, do different strains appear in the adult light organ lobe? But these are difficult experiments. I don't know if we'll be able to do it. If we compete strains from one side of the island versus other strains from the other side of the island in a population of juveniles from one side of the island, does one strain outcompete another? Even if we look at seawater from one side of the island versus the other, is there a difference in their fitness? How is the free-living population on Oahu related to the symbiotic population? So this is a big question mark. Is that one strain that doesn't clade with all the other strains in our splits analysis, is that the exception of the rule? So if we get 10 other free-living strains from Oahu, are they all extremely different, or are they all just randomly all over the place? I don't have an answer to that question right now. The trick here is sampling. Sampling free-living Vibrio fischeri from the marine environment is very difficult. So that's kind of the technical barrier here right now. They're outnumbered by a lot of Vibrio harveyi and other closely related Vibrio naceae, so it's difficult to get them. What are the population dynamics during the lifetime of an adult animal? So now we have some good techniques to look at interspecific differences. So as the squid is just existing in the tanks in our laboratory, which is out of the natural environment but still closer than some systems, is there population dynamics that are happening? Or is it that the host controls everything and is extremely static? I guess host or bacterial symbiont controls everything and is extremely static. That's a question that we'd like to answer. We'd also like to grow our juveniles up to adults and ask the question of, if we inoculate with a certain strain or a set of strains, does that strain persist for the lifetime of the symbiosis, or is it something that can be, it's malleable and can change? I'd like to thank the entire Ruby Lab for putting up with me, especially Ned, my thesis committee, some of which are here, thank you for coming. The funding agencies that have allowed me to work on this really fanciful project, and Ruth Gates for allowing us to stay at the Hawaiian Institute of Marine Biology, Eric for that good idea to bin our gel data, thank you. Steve helped with some Perl scripting that we collaborated on to analyze all these loci, and Ainsley Little for some help with kind of experimental ideas, and Paul Rainey for giving me some of those sequences for the Vibrio naceae that I showed in that last splits graph. And then you for coming on such a rainy day and sitting through a 55-minute talk. Thank you. And I'll take any questions that you have. This is Kaneohe Bay, where we sample squid and Vibrio from. Go ahead.
So have you had a chance to do any sort of the standard population genetic measures that might be relevant to what you're talking about, like FST, various linkage disequilibrium measures?
Yeah, the multi-locus sequence data is all fairly new, like 3 weeks old, and I haven't had time to go through and do that. And I'm also not an expert in population genetics, so I'm trying to form collaborations to learn about it, but I haven't done any of it myself. I mean, I can put it into the programs and see what it says and then read a book, but obviously I'd prefer to collaborate with someone that knows more about that than just reading out of a book. No, but I haven't done it yet. That's the simple answer. Yes?
Do you know if the life histories of the squid are different in the two bays? Normally, cephalopod size is dependent on water temperature, and I'd assume the water temperatures were very similar. So if you have one group that has much smaller animals, they might be having a shorter lifespan, and if that's the group that has, if I remember correctly, that has the shorter living bacteria, that can somehow be related.
Yes, I think that's something that's a big black box, is we don't know the life histories from either bay. And to tell you the truth, Kaneohe is very different than Mauna Loa. Kaneohe has one of the few, is one of the few barrier reefs that exists in the Hawaiian Islands, so it forms a lagoon. So Kaneohe is probably a lot warmer than Mauna Loa would be, which is a shelf reef and is open up to the ocean. I don't know a way to get at that, though. I mean, without doing extensive squid analyses, it's really tough to know what their life history is. You know, they've been caught outside of Oahu as well in the open ocean. So there's evidence from the FST and stuff of the cytochrome oxidase 1 that there was a little bit of gene flow between the Mauna Loa Bay and the Kaneohe Bay squid populations. So
I think if you have the beaks from the squid you have, that you can do some aging on that, and you can get an idea just roughly, like, are all these squid the same age, or did you just get younger ones from one place? Or?
Yeah, the mantle length might be a fairly okay proxy, too, for that. That's a good idea.
I had one other question.
Sure.
What age are you infecting the juveniles in the lab?
The juveniles hatch in about 3 to 4 hours after they hatch, we generally infect them. So we keep them in sterile filtered, I do tank water. So it's water that has been filtered through a 2.2 micron filter to remove all microbes. And they're kept in that tank water, which is the water that they would be in normally minus the microbes, for a few hours. And then we just inoculate from cultures that we've grown up in the lab. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, well, just in humans, I know the earlier you're exposed to something, the more likely you are to keep it. And once you get to a certain stage, once you're past breastfeeding, you're unlikely to take a constitutive, or less likely perhaps to take a constitutive bacteria. It's not like you're doing it really early, so.
Yes, and I think that also gets to what Margaret was talking about with doing different time points, so not just 48 hours, looking at 24, 12, 96. That's just a lot more experiments, so I haven't gotten to it yet. And a lot more juveniles. Anyone else? Scott?
You set up a mixed symbiosis using two different VFRF.
Right, that's the next thing with looking at local adaptation. So,
well, I'd be more interested in seeing whether you find evidence for recombination between those isolates following establishment of the symbiosis.
That is the forte of another member of the lab who I'm trying to collaborate with to work on experimental recombination things, but it's kind of her domain. So there is an effort in the lab to look at recombination among different strains of Vibrio-Fischeri, or even within the same strain of Vibrio-Fischeri. Thank you.
You can thank Michael again.